You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today we are in Saint-Étienne.
The noise you heard there was from the position where we journalists are camped, just past the finishing line, as Alexander Kristoff, the Norwegian, who won stage 12 of the Tour de France, raced past with Peter Sagan just behind him. My name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freeb.
Hello, both.
Another, in inverted commas, routine stage. Lionel shaking his head. Another Peter Sagan second place. He was second for the fourth time today. He said in an interview afterwards that second is his destiny. He seems to have sort of reconciled himself to not winning stages. How many times has he finished third now, Lionel?
He hasn't finished third at all, but he's finished fourth a couple of times, fifth, I think, once, ninth once.
Well, there's a goal for him, a third. Let's go for third one day.
Get a bronze medal to go with his silvers.
Yeah, absolutely. Lionel, I almost forgot, where are we?
We're in Saint-Étienne. We're outside a fairly modern-looking indoor arena of sorts where they have music concerts and things. That's been our press room for the afternoon, and we're kind of on the outskirts of town, really, aren't we? And Saint-Étienne is surrounded by kind of foothills of the Alps over to our west.
Were you here in 2005, Lionel?
I wasn't, no.
I reminded Rich earlier, we were here for the last time trial, 2005, memorable for Michael Rasmussen's Keystone Cops esque performance. He crashed about three times, and then best of all, on the way back to the hotel after the time trial, he got lost and ended up on the motorway. I remember that very vividly, and being here.
I was on sabbatical in 2005. I came back to the sport, had my big comeback
in 2006.
The doping
ban.
No, it wasn't.
In a gap year. David Moncoutier used to call it. He used to say, a lot of riders have gap years these days. meaning that
was,
they were.
It was brushed under the carpet, though, your sabbatical, in inverted commas, Lionel. I think you sound like sneaked it out, not in a press release, but in some anonymous PDF file.
They did.
And it was before Twitter, so nobody. Oh no!
Oh,
just rosé on my computer.
Richard's post-stage rosé has blown over onto his laptop. This could be a catastrophe. It could be a DNF.
Rasmussen-esque. There's something about this place. It's something about Saint-Étienne. It was here in 1985 that the Badger Bernardino crashed in the yellow jersey and broke his nose and put his fifth Tour win in some doubt, although he eventually did win that. But yeah, it's a cursed place, Saint-Étienne, isn't it?
And Vinokourov's adoptive home in France. Another more evidence for it being a cursed place.
Is Nasser Bouhanni not from here?
No.
Is it the home of Agi? No, it's no. Agi Dozera from somewhere. Are they from Grenoble? Aren't they?
Lyon Grenoble
or Chambéry?
Yeah, Chambéry.
Anyway. Let's get this show on the road, shall we?
Yeah, Daniel, you're very quiet. Why are you being so quiet tonight? You're speaking in a very hushed tones.
Really? Yeah. I've not noticed this.
Okay. Right, I think I've got the rosé off my keyboard, so let's crack on. Today's stage, Alexander Kristoff, he was second to André Greipel in London all the way back on stage three. He obviously won Milan San Remo this year. He's a good rider. He's got a lot of support here from the Norwegians. But I thought personally that Sagan had finally got it right today. It was again quite an aggressive stage, quite an aggressive finale. The break had gone, had been brought back, and there were some late attacks, but Sagan was keeping his powder dry in a way that I think we felt he had to. His team came to the front about 4 kilometres to go finally, and he seemed to play right, but then Omega Pharma Quickstep took over and Sagan kind of disappeared.
You know what I enjoyed as well? The hipster in me enjoyed the way that Sagan and Cannondale employed the sweeper today. Did you notice that the sweeper, so I think they had Viviani on his back wheel, which we occasionally see in sprint finishes to prevent anyone else getting on his back wheel. I always enjoy that.
Yeah, it didn't really work though, did it? Because he became
really
detached
work.
From his train. He seemed to almost lose confidence in them at one point and switched over to Omega Pharma.
Yeah, but I mean, I think we spoke about this earlier in the tour, that I think there's a bit of a misnomer about what sprint trains are there for, and that, you know, this idea that you have to be coming off your lead out man's wheel and with 250 metres to go. Often the sprint train is there just to keep it tidy and just to keep the bunch strung out and just to keep, you know, well, just to make room for the team's main sprinter, and they kind of did an okay job in that respect. I mean, he certainly started the sprint from a decent position.
They were all there. Christoph is fast, you know, and Sagan is a great sprinter, but not perhaps the fastest. And Christoph is not a sort of second string guy to lose to. I think you both spoke to a few directeurs sportifs at the start in Bourg-en-Bresse this morning about the sort of Sagan question.
Yeah, well, it is becoming a question now, isn't it? Day after day, Peter Sagan is there, but not quite good enough. He's been close so many times already in this tour. I mean, he's got a runaway lead in the green jersey, but a rider who has that many second places, fourth places, fifth places, he's up there every day but isn't getting the win. It's becoming a little bit like the striker who's just not scored for, you know, 10 matches in a row, and it becomes a story. And that's certainly what it's become now in this tour, particularly with two stages in the Alps now and then a very flat stage into Nîmes on Sunday, which may not necessarily suit him. It might be one for, you know, Christoph again, or André Greipel perhaps, or even Marcel Kittel if he gets over the two Alpine stages. And then we're into the Pyrenees, and so really chances are running out for Peter Sagan. So this morning I spoke to BMC Racing's Max Chiandri and Sky's Kurt Ala Arvesen and Quickstep, Amiga Pharma Quickstep's Brian Holm, and Daniel spoke to Brian Holm's co-director sportif at Amiga Pharma Quickstep, Rolf Audag, and we basically posed the same question, which was, if you were Peter Sagan's sports director, what would you be saying to him, and how would you be getting the team to ride in order to set him up for a victory?
Well, we talked about it actually in our meeting. Strange that he has the team pull the whole day, and then for some reason I think he has lost a little bit of confidence, because he attacks like 5k to go. So you've been pulling the whole day, that means you don't want to get in the sprint. I can give you a clear example. The day when he left with Greg Van Avermaet, what was that? Like four, we didn't finish. And,
just over the little...
Yeah, he went there and he didn't pull. Greg said he didn't pull. So he's afraid of him, then he's afraid of Degenkolb. So what would I do? I'd try and have the race hard by his own teammates and then try and get in a break. Because I guess you're always going to find somebody, wherever he's going to be. Degenkolb is actually up to speed right now. Greg Van Avermaet is there. So he's got a few of them, you know, not the pure flat sprinters, but the intermediate sprinters. And he's afraid of, so I'll try and get in a break.
Is it the case that if a break goes and he's not in it, everyone else sits and watches him, because he is very strong, but he's just not finishing them off at the moment?
No, because we were talking about it yesterday. I think, you know, Yvon Ledanois, we're two directors in car one, was like, would, you know, it's like he said, oh, I wouldn't really go in a break with him. I'd actually go in a break with him, because he would be a big promoter of the break. And then you come to the last 10K and you play your game. You know, it's like a card, and it's like poker. You know, you have to gamble, you have to risk it, you have to challenge him. And I think the only way right now, it's pretty tough start. I mean, the first 35K, not really hard, but then it gets really tricky. I want to control it till there, and then I would actually try and promote a break if I was him, and he's strong enough to bring... You know, you get guys like Chavanel and Bockler, they're going to roll anyway with him in the break, because they just want to be up there in the front, and why not then get to the end and challenge him?
I suppose it's an ultimate test of a rider and their talent when they're up there so consistently, so far clear in the green jersey, but he's just not getting that win, and I suppose the pressure mounts every day and everyone looks at him even more.
Yeah, for sure, the pressure mounts. I could tell by his director yesterday when he was, you know, in the... It's funny because, you know, in the cars, we're all ex-bike riders, a lot of us. And a lot of our ex-bike riders are actually, we race in the same area. So, and you can just tell, and I could see that he was super nervous the way he was driving the car and the way he was coming to the front and you know, talking to his riders and feeding them, that the pressure was on, you know. So
this is a Cannondale
boss. Yeah, this is a Cannondale sport.
Which one?
Zanatta, I think he is driving the car, yeah. Every car usually has two directors now in the car, so it's just a matter of, like, one is obviously the lead director, but it's four eyes and analysing stuff, you know. It just helps each other, you confront a little bit more. So
for your team and the other teams, is there a willingness to let Cannondale do all of that work? Are you happy when they do that, or will you collaborate with them in making it hard, or what's kind of your thinking?
In a way, we're a little bit in the same position as Canada. We need a win. You know, these teams need to win. Big teams need to win. You know, they got the budget. They spend the money. They come here prepared. You know, we have a GC rider with TJ, but we need a win. It's good. A win is just good to everybody. You know, everybody's really working hard. The staff, the riders, everybody's, like, putting everything into it. So just settle things a little bit, you know, and that doesn't take away our vision of where we want to go with the GC rider. So what we're going to do against Cannondale, really nothing. We actually want to ally and team up with them. That's how I see it.
If they feel strong enough to control the race, make it hard on the last climb and stay together, and he still have some guys there until the end, then it's easy, you know. But he might not have that. They did a lot of work yesterday. But for sure, and I think he is also aware of it, it's really hard for him when he goes in the break, because everyone's watching him. So it's not easy, you know, to be a superstar and that fast and that strong. It's never easy, because then you get everyone against you. You know, that's the way he is when he's a superstar. And then, you know, when you're young and talented, some things come easier, and then you become a established superstar like he is. Then it's a lot of pressure, and then it's a lot of responsibility that comes with it. And sometimes it doesn't go the way you really want.
Mike said when he attacked, like, alone after 70 kilometers with 55 k's an hour, I would maybe say, don't save your energy for the final.
As simple as that.
Attacking downhill, I wouldn't consider that alone very good idea. I would say wait for the bunch sprint. You might have a chance to win it, or you don't. But, I mean, attacking alone, that situation, I don't think it's because everybody know Peter Sagan. Nobody really going to ride with him. He's a fantastic cyclist, so the best thing I think he can do is stay calm. And I'm sure he's going to win his stage. He's a damn good cyclist, but... look like he's stressed a little bit now, attacking too much alone.
Is his team doing the job correctly? Because they're very strong until it really matters at the end, and they're leaving him a little bit on his own.
To be fair, when you have Peter Sagan in the team, you have to do a lot of work on your own. And of course, like, they're working stage after stage, I think they get tired also. I think they have a strong team. And of course, when you ride like that, he's sitting alone in the final. But of course, they don't have many supports, because his Peter Sagan is obvious. So he have it hard, you know. They got a hard time here, but I think they're doing a good job, but maybe staying a bit more calm in the final. And I'm sure he can win. We beat him one day, very small margin, just like 1 or 2 centimeters probably. We won. That would say we could do the race a little bit from behind. That's always like that, you know. So that's our advantage. We won one stage, and normally you won one, the next one going to come more easy. We knew that already. And the problem is, of course, we like 3-4 teams fighting what we call for the middle stages. We can do it with Matteo, and we can do it with Kwiatkowski. But nobody's that stupid. They're going to go to a breakaway, with a breakaway to the finish with Peter Sagan, because 9 times out of 10, he's going to beat you. So of course you stop pulling when you're sitting with him, then you maybe have a little chance to beat him. So he know it, he know that's the game.
I said I really feel sorry for him. He just don't have the team. If you're next to you with Tinkoff or Astana, whatever I read in the media,
yeah,
he probably would have won 4 stages. But it's really not my mistake that they don't have the team together that can really bring him to the line.
Yeah.
The other thing is, and they also agreed to say, why is he helping that down? Why do you not take that risk? Keep your energy, keep your resource. You had one guy with you. You make him chasing like crazy. Just stay 25th in that group. Be invisible. Everybody looks at Sagan because he's always so present in the front. He dictates the final. And this is, in my opinion, now it's proved, it doesn't work. He tried it 4 times. He, like, Contador attacks in Sheffield, he goes next to him, over him, saying, hey, if, I mean, you can't display you more than that. You know, I'm the strongest here. Why would you do it? The only thing that counts is on the line. Well, he was still here, you know, look bad, look weak, and everybody wants to win. So you have a group of 30 with three of us. We would have closed in the final.
Yeah.
If we have a group of 40 with four of us, we would have closed together.
Yeah.
But not at the front. But that was his chance. If he stays in that group, only Galopin is in front, we would have closed 100%. I understand that frustration, but I think it's pretty normal. I think if we have a dead flat stage and they go away, we will not ride with Kittel's team. Why? The only way to beat Kittel is reduce the numbers, so he's not having his lead out anymore. He has to sacrifice so many people to get into the final that he will be alone in the final, and that's the only way to beat him. Mm. It would be the same thing. So again, like for me, he deserves it. He deserves a stage win, but not a stage that we can win.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Freib.
So we heard there in order from Max Chiandri, BMC. So
that's the Anglo-Italian accent.
Yeah.
Then we heard what?
Kurt Arvidsson.
Anglo-Norwegian.
And then we heard from Brian Holm. And then
Anglo-Danish.
Anglo-Danish. And then we heard from Rolf Aldag.
Just perfect English, Rolf.
Perfect
Aldag,
English.
Pretty much.
Now, actually, we didn't really need to interview Max Chiandri for that clip, because Daniel does a fantastic Max Chiandri impersonation, don't you, Daniel?
Not tonight, guys, you know.
Got the hair as well.
Yeah, that's, you know.
Come on, Daniel.
Give us a bit of Max
on Cav.
It's, you know, Cav is Cav, you know. It's too early in the tour for all that.
Okay. Oh, we've got to bring Max back at some point. And see, we'll play them together and see if we can spot the difference. We can might run a competition. Guess which is which. Speaking of competitions, you're running a competition at the moment, Lionel, aren't you? Can you update us on your competition?
Yeah, indeed. We, yesterday's blog on thecyclingpodcast.com, we set all those armchair sports directors out there the task of naming the perfect Tour de France team, with the goal of winning the 2014 Tour de France. Entries have been flooding in, some of them very funny, some of them very good, but some of them perhaps falling into the obvious pitfalls of picking, you know, two or three of the best climbers and getting the likes of Tony Martin, Peter Sagan, Nairo Quintana, Chris Froome, all in the same lineup, a kind of all-stars team, which is not necessarily what we were looking for. We were looking for the kind of the perfect blend of riders that will complement one another. But Dave Brailsford will be picking the best lineup on the second rest day, and the prizes on offer are a copy of Richard's book Etape and a complete set of the cycling anthology.
I started compiling a team today of the nine riders with the best hair in the tour, and I got about four names, and then I got distracted by something else. It was Fuglsang was definitely there, Kittel was there, Peter Velits was there, and Alex Howes, a bit of a sleeper, you know, a bit of a new entry there. But
what about Daniel Oss? He's normally in those kind of lists as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's another name.
So Chris Horner.
That's the alternative list. If anyone wants to pitch in with sort of best Barnetts of the tour.
Yeah, Chris Horner is an inspiration for Lionel, certainly.
In so many ways.
I mean, drifting back quickly to Peter Sagan, Daniel's been working like a beaver on a blog about Peter Sagan, which will be going up imminently on thecyclingpodcast.com. I was in the village this morning, and I watched Peter Sagan ride past with his Cannondale teammates, and Daniel, you've alluded to this before, but just watching him, he is a specimen, isn't he? I mean, you watch, Sagan is a different sort of shape, a different physique to just about any other rider. He is, you know, there are, you occasionally get these sort of outliers, Usain Bolt, when you watch a, you know, eight sprinters line up, there's one guy that just looks different to everybody else. And Sagan, he is just, he's a monster. I mean, the musculature, the physique is just extraordinary, really.
He's got Sean Kelly-esque calves, hasn't he? Very big calves.
He's sort of bulkier, much bulkier than Kelly, though. He's bulkier than most bike riders. You know, Kittel's another one who's very, very bulky, but with Kittel, there's sort of bulk with Sagan, it's just pure muscle.
yeah, I think if I can plagiarise myself, sort of quote something I wrote earlier this year, he's kind of like a big bear, a grizzly bear, sort of pouring meat off a sort of fresh kill.
Sounds like me eating my bourgogne breast chicken last night, exactly. Doesn't it?
Very, very similar indeed. Very similar. Sagan-esque. What? We're going to talk in the rest of this podcast a little bit more about the days to come. I think we're heading into the Alps now. We're going to talk as well about Jonathan Tiernan Locke, the Team Sky rider who has been found guilty of doping today and served a 2-year suspension. Given that Dave Brailsford's going to be running the rule over our fantasy lineups, perhaps best not to include Jonathan Tiernan Locke in any of those lineups. That might be a shrewd move. Not that it has been so far, but anyway, we'll get on to that later. I mean, anything else come up today? There was Vincenzo Nibali, obviously held the yellow jersey, no great scares for him today. And Daniel, I think in his press conference today, I was working on Jonathan Tiernan Locke and I was away speaking to Dave Brailsford about that. We'll hear a bit of audio from that later on. But Nibali, I understand, was finally asked some questions about doping today.
Well, yeah, he was asked specifically about the association of his team with Alexander Vinokourov. So Vinokourov is sort of the general manager of Astana, and then also the main direct sportif, Giuseppe Martinelli. We touched on this yesterday. He, for many years, was Marco Pantani's director sportif. And Nibali, I would say, answered with some aplomb, really. He didn't really flinch. He gave fairly stock responses. He said that cycling's changed and, you know, with the biological passport, intensified testing, and a new generation, new attitudes, that, you know, there was reason for people to believe not just in him but in the current crop of riders. Like I say, the actual substance of what he said was not perhaps all that impressive, but he was certainly very willing to answer the question. Quite different in a way, even from the likes of Alberto Contador we've seen over the past few years. There's a kind of a noticeable sort of tensing of the muscles and the a kind of clamming up that has been with people like Contador. Nibali seemed perfectly relaxed and perfectly happy to answer those questions tonight.
We discussed the doping and the difference in the questioning of Nibali as opposed to Team Sky the last couple of years. We got a very interesting we discussed that in last night's podcast, and we had a very interesting email today from a listener who suggested that he enjoyed the discussion, but he said, "My suggestion is that although you touched on lots of the major issues, I don't think you really got to the heart of the matter, because you were very sensibly trying to rationalise what is fundamentally an irrational and emotion-driven debate." Very interesting. Might ask him to expand on that in a blog or something, perhaps, but a very interesting argument where he says that the discussion is often fundamentally emotional rather than logical.
Team Sky, they attracted all of those questions, and I think Matt Bowden hinted at this in our Velo News podcast from a couple of days ago, which if you haven't listened to, you can find on our Audio Boo page or on thecyclingpodcast.com if you want to catch up with that. But Matt made quite an interesting point that Sky kind of left the door ajar for the question about doping to be asked, and once that door was ajar, a tidal wave of people rushed through it, if I can use that rather ungainly metaphor. But basically, once...
It's not like you, Lionel.
No, exactly. I thought that one through. So once the gloves were off in terms of asking Sky questions about doping, the question became dominant. That became the theme of last year's tour, but also 2012, when Bradley Wiggins was in the yellow jersey and was asked day after day whether he was doping, what he can say, and he was giving the same answer every day, but it didn't satisfy people or cause them to stop asking that same question. Whereas, you know, you look at Nibali and his associations, but the difference is that the Astana team has never said we are zero tolerance, or, you know, it's not necessarily that they presenting a doping's okay kind of front, but they've not been as strident in their anti-doping stance as Sky. And so when Sky's stance was zero tolerance, 100% clean, everything, all of that, people looked for chinks in that argument. And because of the history of the sport over the last 15-20 years, as we know, it's very, very hard to hire people who worked in cycling in the 1990s, who were riders in the 1990s, who wouldn't have come across the doping issue.
I think that only becomes a problem, a sort of red rag to a herd of bulls, probably not the collective noun for bulls, but when you combine that desire for transparency, those kind of public statements about anti-doping, with superiority in Grand Tours in particular, you know, Garmin Slipstream have had a history and sort of set themselves up as a clean team, a transparent team, a team that welcome questions about doping, but they have never really combined with that, the sort of dominance in Grand Tours. And
well, as Richard made the point in his blog on the eve of the tour, right at the very start of the tour, David Miller was almost like a lightning rod for the doping question in the Garmin Sharp squad. So he was kind of carrying the can, really, whether intentionally or not. He was directing the attention away from Christian van der Velde, Ryder Heyerdahl, Jonathan Voorthuis even, who we now know and at the time suspected had doped in their past careers. So Sky haven't had that same situation. They said we wouldn't hire anyone with any association with doping, and of course lots of associations with doping are not in the public domain, or they certainly weren't then. And so therefore, as things came to light over, or we thought came to light, there have been a rash of people who have left Team Sky at the end of 2012 because of the reasoned decision report into the Lance Armstrong doping ring, if I can call it that. So the inconsistencies kind of got highlighted, and it adds up into a sort of a dossier which perhaps provides more evidence for the prosecution than perhaps really is kind of appropriate or justifiable when you think about the regime the team's actually running.
This is a great irony, isn't it, that David Miller was prevented from joining Team Sky. Had he joined, he would probably have deflected a lot of the questions that they've got, because he is in a sort of unique position and has been a very effective spokesman for Garmin Sharp over the last few years. He could have perhaps performed that same role for Team Sky. But let's move on. We're going to sort of move sideways, because we're going to talk in the next section about the news today about Jonathan Tiernan-Locke.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Welcome back to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. We're here in St Etienne. And there was another irony today concerning Team Sky. A couple of days ago on the rest day, Dave Brailsford challenged journalists with the question, why are there no doping questions this year? Well, there were today, because it was announced during the stage that Jonathan Tiernan-Locke, the Team Sky rider, has been served with a 2-year ban for doping. It's a biological passport transgression that dates back to a blood test in September 2012 during the Tour of Britain, which he won when he was on a different team in Jura. He joined Team Sky 4 months later, and with that initial blood test, September 2012, added to further blood tests in the early part of 2013, the biological passport profile that built up showed suspicious fluctuations in the eyes of the biological passport committee. Daniel, you're looking to come in here.
This seems quite odd to me. If we look at the most recent cases of biological passport infraction, so Kreuziger, and even going back before that, Leonardo Bertagnoli, the Italian, they seem to be based on an awful lot of data, multiple years of data, and specifically year by year for year comparisons. So no dossier, no official information has ever been made public about this, but my assumption with those was that they had perhaps compared, for instance, May 2011 with May 2012. Now, with the Tiernan-Locke case, if we're only talking about a period of 3 or 4 months over which there were fluctuations, big fluctuations, well, that is my assumption, that the fluctuations were pretty dramatic, if they could make a ruling on such a small amount of data.
It's been an interesting case. I mean, it first came to light September 2013, which, as you say, Daniel, was only 1 year after his first ever test. So certainly year-on-year testing, you imagine, wouldn't have come into consideration there. It's taken from September 2013 until July 2014 to reach a verdict. That verdict has been reached by UK Anti-Doping. It was the first biological passport case they have ever sat in judgment on, and they've come to the verdict that he is guilty. Now, we don't know yet whether he will appeal. His agent, Andrew McQuaid, was in the press room today before the verdict was announced. He disappeared, I think, by the time it was. So I think our colleague Owen Slot did have a quick word with him about it. He said he wouldn't talk about it until they decided whether there would be an appeal. I would imagine there probably will be appeal because, as far as I know, Tiernan Locke still maintains that he is innocent. He said all along that he is innocent. He would fight to clear his name. He has failed to do so so far, but clearly I think that it's probably not over. We spoke to Dave Brailsford. I spoke to Dave Brailsford at the finish. He was obviously much in demand and certainly no shortage of doping-related questions. Here he was outside the Team Sky bus offering a few thoughts on Jonathan Tiernan Locke.
Well, we respected the process, you know, of the whole thing, and now that the process has been concluded, you know, we terminated the contract with immediate effect. And we know that the violation was before he joined Team Sky, and obviously we set out with our ambition of a British team, you know, British rider to win the Tour, clean, and there's no cheats, there's no place for cheats in this sport, and certainly not on Team Sky, so... You know, that's the situation.
Are you satisfied that the process then has found the correct outcome with Jonathan Tiernan Locke, given what you know about it?
Well, I think the process is a process, and you've got to respect the judgment of the process, really. And I don't think I'm expert enough to be able to question the outcome. What I'm saying is, given the outcome, then we respect that. We terminate his contract. There's no place for cheats in his sport, and there's certainly no place for cheats in Team Sky.
What could you have done differently in terms of the recruitment process and checking him out?
Well, actually, the significant test was one. It was his first ever biological passport test, and given that it's a longitudinal test, one test in isolation doesn't quite. You know, you've got to have the rest of the test before you recognise. You know, you see what I mean? So it's a longitudinal test. So, what we have done since, of course, is we've stopped and very much looked at our governance. We've got a new governance and compliance officer. We're scrutinising. You know, real detail now, all the information that we've got, and our monitoring, I'd say, is second to none. So I think that's the learning from it. But as a first biological test back in September 2012. But it does raise the issue about recruiting riders without a biological passport history.
So we should not do that again.
Well, I think you've got to in this sport. You know, you can't just, you know, there's a certain age and a certain, you know, if you come up through a pro continental team, for example, if you wanted to take on any neo pros, they haven't got biological passports. So, you know, there's an element of must in the situation. But, you know, the more work that we can do on it, the better it is. And at the end of the day, if the process is helping catch people who are trying to cheat, albeit before they came to our team, then it's all well and good. I think when somebody knows clearly what your stance is, and then, you know, if they disregard that and come all the same, then yeah, you do feel let down by it. There's no denying that. But like I say, you know, we're pushing in a way to try and create a new phase of the sport. He didn't cheat with us. He cheated before he got here. But like I say, there's no place for cheats in our sport.
Are you confident he didn't cheat with you? I mean, that you know, there was nothing going on when he was on the team.
Well, there's nothing that we could see in the data that we had to suggest there was nothing, no anomalies then.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So we heard there from Dave Brailsford talking about Jonathan Tiernan Locke. It seems quite clear that he has washed his hands of him and regards the verdict as a fair one, and he's been sacked. And Dave Brailsford also said that he would not be speaking to him. Quite a contrast to his treatment of David Miller back in 2004, when he was with Miller when he confessed to doping and he did stand by him. Circumstances obviously completely different. Let's move on to some lighter topics, and to that end we have been joined here in Saint-Étienne by our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio from Gazzetta dello Sport.
So the best at the end, as usual, as often happens.
We save the best to the end, absolutely.
Exactly. How are you?
Here. Good, yeah. How are you, Ciro?
Fine, always fine when
I'm
here.
How are you coping with the stress and the pressure of reporting every day on the yellow jersey?
No, I mean, I'm not really stressful about that. Also because one day after another, hands on end of the tour is coming, but mainly my holidays are coming.
Your holidays.
So yeah, exactly.
You're
you're
on holiday just before the tour, no?
Yes, before the tour, but also I will go on holidays again after the tour.
Where, Ciro?
I can anticipate only for you, Greece. This year, Greece, yeah. So the very end of the Tour de France will be not the 27th of July, but the 1st of August. So, I mean, the first day in which I will be in Greece.
What about if Nibali wins the Tour? Presumably there'll be some kind of, there'll be some after party in Italy. The Italians go mad for Tour de France wins. There haven't been many. This will be the first Italian winner possibly of the Tour in your career as a cycling judge. Am I correct? Were you working when Pantani won in 98?
No. At 98, I was. And I don't want to say that I was a kid, but I was at university, no cycling at all. No. It will be the first time. Yeah.
So that would be a huge moment for you as well as for Nibali.
Yeah. A huge moment. And you did a good question about let's imagine that Vincenzo at the end win the Tour de France. It's a possibility. Who will cover from the Gazzetta all the events post-tour by Vincenzo? This is a good question. At this question, I can't answer now.
Well, is Vincenzo maybe going to hold these events in Greece? Is that a possibility?
I don't know if circuits of cycling are organized in Greece. Unfortunately, I don't think so. Also, Lionel, you are a little bit skeptical about
that. Well, I can see your summer holidays being in Boxmeer in Holland and in small towns in Belgium.
A little trip to Sicily, back to the family video store in Sicily.
In my opinion, the best man to go to Sicily. Family of Vincenzo, all his relatives, because I already know very well his father, his mother, all his cousins. This is the service for me, not the circuit.
And you should explain to you're from the south of Italy, aren't you? And we all know, you know, that people from the south of Italy, without being too discriminatory here, it's a different country, isn't it, the south of Italy?
Comparing it to the north, yeah. Mainly, I don't want to say maybe two different countries, but yes, it's true, there are really differences. In this case, Vincenzo is a mixture, I mean, because he was born in Sicily, he grew up a little bit in Sicily, but then he moved from Tuscany to become a professional cyclist, and now he lives in Switzerland, so close to Italy, but so more or less north, center, south.
Lovely tax regime in Switzerland, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the reasons for the fact that Nibali now... Yes. I think one of them, I don't think it's the only one, but it's maybe one of the main reasons. Also, I think it's the same for Alberto Contador. Now they live really together.
They live together?
Revelation. As usual, I need, as you say, some English classes. Not together, I mean, very close.
Yeah. One thing I want to ask you about, Ciro, goes back a few days. Now, you're a man who's never very far from your mobile phone. You're always, you've always got your phone near at hand. You're either texting or you're speaking to somebody. Now, the other day, a few days ago, Luca Paolini, who is another rider you know very, very well, I often see you speaking to him at the start.
Not anymore.
The bearded Paolini. Oh, we'll get onto that. The bearded Paolini. Now, he was photographed the other day using his phone mid-race, texting or tweeting or something. Was he texting you?
No. He wasn't texting me. He said that he forgot his smartphone in this jersey, and so he saw him, and so he took him to come back with the smartphone to the car.
So he found that he left it in his jersey by mistake.
Exactly. And I mean, so, his version, I mean.
So he texted the car to say, come and get my phone.
No, I don't think so. I mean, the phone was off, and so maybe it would only like to come back to the car. But I'm not sure that his version is true. Eh? I can't say that.
So has there been some fracture in your relationship with Paolini?
Yeah, because normally, you know, dear Lionel, because you are in front of me, eh? I want to explain to our listeners, I don't have a lot of trust in the world of cycling. How can I explain you? Maybe, I don't know why, but this is my kind of attitude to the world of cycling. Speak and also write without, I don't want to say to be skeptical, but not to give really 100% certainties about anything.
So you think sometimes when people are talking to you, they're not necessarily telling you the truth?
Exactly.
What's this got to do with your relationship with Paolini? Can you shed any more light on
this? I mean, I was a little bit upset with our article of Gazzetta dello Sport about this fact of the text.
Didn't he accuse you
of smoking illegal substances?
Yes, and I have to say that in my life never used substance. I don't know if maybe
never
you believe me.
Never tested positive.
I understand that it's difficult to believe, but I can assure you. But as a matter of fact, I can say about today's stage, Christoph, a teammate of Paulini, won. After the end of the stage, I realized a video for our web TV with Paulini was nice, I must confess.
So the bridge has been built there, you're friends again.
Maybe. We'll see in next days.
Can we talk about the Alps, the two stages in the Alps coming up?
Chiro, you might want to get back to your work now, dear, because you hate the mountains. You're more of a beach man.
Exactly. I'm not the right person to talk about mountains.
It's not a great tour for you, is it? We're not really going near any beaches. The day in Nîmes, we're fairly close. Carcassonne, the rest day, you might sneak off, maybe.
That this tour is completely different from the tour of last year. Last year, Corsica, Côte d'Azur, Saint-Malo, Mont Saint-Michel. This year, nothing. It's a shame. Maybe I should talk to Christian Prudhomme for next year.
Piero, thank you. We'll speak to you again, I hope, soon. Now, let's talk about the next couple of days. And we've got some housekeeping to do, actually, before we do that. Follow us on Twitter at @cycling_podcast. We've got a website, thecyclingpodcast.com. Find us and like us on Facebook. And if you do, you stand a chance to win a pair of Oakleys. We'll be announcing a new competition soon to win a phone call from Dan Martin on the next rest day. I suppose he could probably call any day, couldn't he? He's not riding the tour, which probably don't need to do on a rest day.
I've tried calling some riders who aren't here over the last few days, and they've been ignoring my calls.
That's a foregone conclusion. Well, I do have to report from the Jonathan Votters phone call, which happened on Tuesday, on the first rest day, that our winner was Sonia. Daniel, can you help me with the German name, please?
Latviasen.
Sonia Latviasen. I think she's in Frankfurt. I could be wrong, but I think she's in Frankfurt.
Hamburg.
Sorry, Sonia. She won the contest to win a phone call from Jonathan Votters. We were intrigued by her tweet, which said that she didn't feel that JV knew that what he'd done for German cycling. Now, we wondered if she'd made a mistake meant Jens Voigt instead of Jonathan Votters, but no, she meant Jonathan Votters, and she sent us an email. The phone call lasted 9 minutes, and she said it was a pretty insightful chat about what happened to his team and Andrew Talansky, who didn't start today's stage, having had his battle the previous day, and his role as a team manager in a growing organisation about cycling and music, and where those two worlds clash. That sounds interesting. But what she really wanted to tell me about German cycling was that she lives in Hamburg, as you said there. Hamburg hosts the UCI race, the Hamburg Cyclassics. And she says, I still remember vividly the press conference of Erik Zabel and Rolf Aldag in 2007 when they admitted to using EPO. Subsequently, the following Hamburg races were only advertised with pictures of the amateur race, which takes part on the same route. When Tyler Farrar, the Garmin Sharp rider, won in Hamburg in 2009 and 2010, they started to advertise once again with a picture of the professional race. So she felt, because Garmin had this clear anti-doping stance, so she felt that Garmin and Jonathan Votters deserved a little bit of credit for that, particularly with Bora coming in as a sponsor of the NetApp Enduro team, and German television rumoured to be returning to the tour next year. So that sounds like it went well, and we'll, as I say, be starting the other competition in the next day or so.
Lovely stuff. Lovely. Let's talk about the mountains, because we're going into the Alps on Friday and Saturday. I don't know how you guys feel, but when I saw the tour route, the lack of kind of outstanding, famous summit finishes in the Alps did kind of smart a little bit. I know the Vosges have been very interesting. They've mixed the race up a lot. The Pyrenees are spectacular and incredibly hard, and something has to give. So the Alps are perhaps not as difficult. Although the climb up to Chamrousse does look pretty hard. They've used one of the roads up there in time trial, but not gone quite as far as they are going, I don't think, tomorrow. But the tour without Alpe d'Huez is always lacking something, I feel. But also to be without, you know, any of the other big alpine climb. Daniel's shaking his head here. He's
disgusted. He's disgusted.
The Alpe d'Huez is too mainstream for Daniel.
He's a hipster. It's not the hipster's mountain, is it?
So what's your beef with that particular argument?
Alpe d'Huez is a gimmick, as far as I'm concerned. You know, made its first appearance in the Tour in 1952. It didn't. You know, I like a pass, Lionel. I like roads that were built for a very clearly discernible reason that goes beyond sport and cycling. Alpe d'Huez, the road was built for a ski resort, really.
The road leads up to Murphy's Bar, the Irish pub at the top.
That's a really interesting subject, Daniel. Is there anywhere we can read more about, you know, the history of these roads and these mountains?
You want to know how much higher the Grand Ballon d'Alsace is than Strasbourg Cathedral? I could probably recommend the odd tome. But anyway, going back to the climbs in this year's Tour de France, Chamarus is hard. It is 18.2 kilometres, 7.3%. That is a very long climb, even by Tour standards. And, you know, you say, Lionel, there's a lack of kind of iconic finishes. Certainly we've got Chamarus and Rizal in the Alps. They've done what Christian Prudhomme has done very well this year, is picking out some, you know, new climbs that we've not heard of or not done before. The Col de Palaquis, which is the first category climb that comes before Chamarus tomorrow, it's 14.1% at 14.1 kilometres at 6.1%, but that's very deceptive. There are some really, really nasty sections in that. So I think tomorrow there will be fireworks. It's not an intimidating profile, and we often see nowadays that, you know, the days with 5-6 sort of first, second, Hawcastle climb, sorry. But I think we'll see a real race to the bottom of the Col de Palaquis tomorrow, then a real race down the other side, another steep descent, and Chamarus, I think, will be a real grandstand finale.
Prudhomme is very good at trying to put together, and his team, trying to put together a route that will encourage aggression. And I think you're absolutely right about those stages that look incredibly hard with five mountain passes, over mountain after mountain after mountain. They end up being pretty defensive stages, particularly in the current era. We don't see the kind of Claudio Chiappucci style exploits anymore, and that's arguably a good thing. We're getting into the phase of the race now where the challengers to Vincenzo Nibali, they can start chalking off the days, really. If they don't make a move at Chamarus, then they're beginning to run out of time, because one of the stages in the Pyrenees will be kind of neutralized in some way. It's just the way the Tour always works out. Are they going to race quite conservatively in the Alps and save it all for the Pyrenees?
Daniel's looking disgusted again. I think tomorrow's a day for Thibaut Pinot, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Suits him down to the ground. I mean, it's maybe a little bit long for it to be perfect for him. I mean, if you speak to his brother, who's his coach, he says that Pinot is exceptional over sort of 30, 40 to 40 minute efforts. Tomorrow will probably be a bit longer, 18.2 kilometres, but yeah, it's percentage-wise, 7.3%, pretty steady. It will suit him really well.
He had a little problem today. He was off the back. Did he just puncture?
That's not unusual, though, is it? He's often sort of losing position. And
but he was off the back. He punctured.
He punctured.
Back in, no problems there.
Yeah.
Great. Shall we wrap it up there, fellas? Because we've got a big weekend ahead of us. And I think Lionel alluded to our chicken dinner last night. You can find that on his blog, Gourmet de France blog, on lionelburney.com. I had a read of that today, Lionel.
Good.
Catching up
good?
On it.
I'm yet to log on, Lionel, but I will today.
Yeah, catching up. I was just reminding myself of where we'd actually been the last few days. Quite useful.
You can see how the other half lived, Daniel, you know.
Also, what day is it? I don't even know what day is it.
The day is
Thursday. Someone Friday. Thursday.
There was a rumour in the press room that it was Thursday. And there were all sorts of rumours yesterday. Someone said that... No, they said there was a story on Sportster about Sagan going to Astana, and I went to talk to Ciro about this, because Ciro obviously is very well connected, particularly with Sagan's agent, Giovanni Lombardi. And I went to see Ciro, and Luca Gialanella, who is Ciro's colleague from the Gazzetta dello Sport, was sitting next to him. And I said, Ciro, what's this about Sagan to Astana? And Luca piped up. He said, it's the Tour, isn't it? The rumours, some of the rumours are crazy. He said, if someone said Pantani was standing over there, then 50% of the press room would believe it.
Absolutely. It's confusing, though, the day of the week thing, because we had a rest day on a Tuesday as opposed to Monday. I think that's throwing a lot of people. I believe today is Thursday, but I wouldn't swear by that.
Should we confirm that tomorrow? Should we check that?
Yeah, we'll go and check that now, and we will come back tomorrow and confirm that would mean that tomorrow's Friday, and we'll confirm that tomorrow. In the meantime, let's wrap it up. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.